Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Shift Extension podcast. Your hosts here today, Sonny and Nick. And we've got a very special guest on, which we'll introduce in a moment. Sonny, it's great to have you back, mate.
Appreciate it, Nick. I'm excited about this one. This is Trailblazers and Trendsetters.
Yeah. It's our first nurse on the podcast.
It is indeed. That's I think it's hugely important too to get some of that that cross-professionalism collaboration going on. So very excited about it.
Fantastic. So without further ado, we'd like to introduce Kate Carmody to the show. How are you, Kate?
Oh, good. Hi, Nick. Hi, Sonny. Thank you for that introduction. Yes, registered nurse, single degree. I'd like to think I was a three-quarter paramedic, but I'm here still working.
I tell a lot of people that I work with that we're street nurses, but they don't. I don't know. There seems to be a division between us.
We go with that. Where are you working at the moment?
Yeah, registered nurse for about 12 years now, Nick. I am a clinical nurse at the Gold Coast University Hospital in ED and work in a private medical service as well, which allows me to do a little bit of pre-hospital care.
Fantastic. And you're ex-defence?
Yeah, ex-military. I was a full-time army nursing officer for about 8 years, which saw me posting to Darwin and Brisbane. And I joined up as an undergrad back when I was in uni and was sponsored to do a couple of years as a new grad at Robina Emergency Department, then posted to Darwin, spent quite a few years in the military sort of medicine space.
And how'd you find coming over to doing that medicine in the civilian world?
Not too bad. Like, I took away a lot of really great experiences and opportunities in defence that I was able to translate into emergency nursing, which my background was always sort of a bit of critical care, emergency pre-hospital, but also primary healthcare too, which was a big part of military medicine and ensuring that soldiers were always ready for deployments and their health was at the best capability they could be. So translating across, it was not too difficult at all. A lot of things that military medicine do really well, particularly in trauma, that translate in some of the trauma hospitals that I worked at in Brisbane and on the Gold Coast.
That's an interesting point. I also come from a military background, and when you move into, I guess, the civilian versions of what we do, I found one of the biggest transitions for me was, I better not say everyone because I'll be grossly overgeneralizing here, but most of the soldiers, most of the people that we dealt with were, I guess, already pre-screened and relatively healthy people. And so a lot of the medical-based approaches was on trauma-related incidents rather than, you know, chronic health conditions. And so even my own transition into civilian paramedicine I found quite interesting because it was no longer that pre-screened, you know, expeditionary fit, capable soldier. It was certainly more the general public.
Yes, yeah, you're correct, Sonny. So coming back to civilian emergency nursing, some things I hadn't seen for a long time, like your end-stage renal kidney diseases or drug abuse and things like that, which I hadn't had a lot of experience managing or treating. Most of our soldiers were really healthy, fit men and women who most of the injuries they did sustain were like musculoskeletal injuries, which were, you know, treatable. And we had lots of resources within the military environment, such as physios, that could manage those conditions.
Certainly a lack of geriatrics and pediatrics, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. There is a set retirement age, but on look at some of the older defence personnel were incredibly fit and strong and very had a lot of endurance in them.
Kate, we wanted to get you on today to talk about an operation you led earlier this year. We'd love to hear about that experience. Give our listeners a bit of context. This was during the recent flood event in northern New South Wales, is that correct?
Yeah, so the northern New South Wales flood event, which, I mean, you'd have to have lived under a rock to have not heard about it. It was broadcast all over Australia and the world. One of the worst disasters for floods in Australia and in the Northern Rivers area. It was catastrophic, and social media everywhere it was broadcast, and it was really confronting for everybody. And I think a lot of people tried to find a way of helping, whether it was donating money or time or turning up to these regions to volunteer and help in the cleanup aid or man volunteer hubs. So that was initially what I had wanted to do with myself and my husband, was just to go down, help, volunteer just for the day and help with cleanup. And the more I thought about it and started to plan, you know, our trip down, because it's a 2-hour trip from the Gold Coast to the Northern Rivers, I was like, well, why don't we just take a couple of extra things, like some dressings, a couple of pieces of equipment. My husband, fortunately, is a general practitioner, so I was able to get a few antibiotics and things, and it just kept rolling from there. So the time we left was March 6th. It was a couple of days post the rain event, but still significant flooding, significant amount of people that were still stuck in place and displaced, that when we did eventually get down there, it was just completely obvious what gap in the healthcare system that people were experiencing. And that meant that they couldn't access healthcare. Healthcare was it was completely destroyed. All the health facilities, all the clinicians that lived in that space, those areas were displaced themselves. They couldn't make their own way to their shifts, or pharmacies were completely depleted of all their consumables. And it was just a complete mess down there. So what we did, and what I developed really quickly overnight, was essentially a bespoke medical capability that would reach out to all these displaced people that could provide them primary health medical care. And that's what I sort of established or identified that the real need was. And I guess I did it the right way. Well, I think it was the right way. So I made contact with the functional area coordinator for the disaster space in the Northern Rivers. So what that meant was that I wanted to gain permission and credibility to reach out and enter these vulnerable communities, because I was aware there was a lot of well-meaning volunteers that were turning up to help, portraying themselves as medical clinicians, but they didn't really have a scope or anyone to answer to as far as what they were doing, what they were administering, and in who these people really were. So we got all those permissions and a small amount of jobs to start with on the first day. So we made our way down to, when I say we, so my husband, who was a GP, and a couple of colleagues that were paramedics and registered nurses. We went down and pretty much started from the north side of Lennox Head, Ballina, and just started seeing people in the evacuation centres. And what we were able to do was re-prescribe medications, administer tetanus shots, review flood-related wounds that were, you know, consumed with all sorts of nasty bacteria from the floodwaters. But there's also some interesting cases, like in Lennox Head, people that were en route to places like the Gold Coast, possible for outpatient appointments, that were stuck in place. There was a mum with her son who had cerebral palsy, and so we were able to help bedside with some IDC replacements and PEG feeding, and really just optimise him so that when the time was to move, that he was safe to go. But the biggest difference, I think, was as we've continued to move further south, I mean, this was initially only meant to be a day deployment. We reached a rural town called Corakai, and I'd never heard of Corakai until we stumbled upon it, pretty much. And when I say stumble upon it, we travelled across the Richmond River Bridge, which was just nasty and brown, full of, you know, horrible scenes like deceased swollen animals and just dishevelled locals. And Corakai had only just opened a couple of hours earlier, so it was just buzzing. There were rural fireys everywhere, foot patrol of military personnel, police. It was radio chatter. It was just going off. And we quickly found the medical centre on site there and introduced ourselves, and they were clearly zapped. They'd been looking after the locals as best they could for probably, I think the town itself had been closed for, well, 5 days by that point. So we assisted where we could, and by that time that our day was done and we drove back to the Gold Coast, and I was just, how, like, this is not enough. Like, clearly people need more. They can't, you know, we're already burdened in the hospital system, that we're going through a current pandemic, we're suffering hospital ramping, but these people need just basic primary health. They're GPs, they can't access. And so I was like, well, how can we do better? So again, liaising with New South Wales Health, and I was able to get more equipment, more staff, and quickly sort of developed an operations plan of how we would do this in a real a mission statement. And, you know, the Reggie side of me created a SMEAC over like a couple of hours or so. And how are we going to do this? It was really clear and, you know, taking into all sorts of considerations, because it wasn't, you know, there's things that we did need to consider, like our safety and, you know, really make sure that it was efficient and, you know, evidence-based and all those sorts of things, so that we were doing it the right way and the best way and to reach as many people as we could. So the things that we took in mind were I was aware that people were still displaced. They're literally families marooned on islands. A lot of people chose not to leave. They didn't want to leave because for fear of looters, for fear of missing opportunities with services that were coming to clean their houses. They didn't, their cars were run off. So we made a point of the next day, we took down again clinicians, paramedics, nurses. We had a full truck, two trucks full of equipment, antibiotics, Baguza, and tetanus as well, and things like that.
Can I ask a quick question? How many days in are we now?
This is our second day in. So the first day was a long trip in that we only spent a couple of hours in Coroccohuayc. Coroccohuayc ended up being our main area of operation.
This is a long day.
It is a long day. So it's a two-hour trip from the Gold Coast, which is where I live, but we had clinicians that would come with us that were coming from as far as the sunny coast. Wow. So those first couple of days, we actually still continued to go down in a volunteer capacity. And by the third day, New South Wales Health realised what capability we were providing, like we were reaching out and making some real significant differences and allowing people to get what they needed. And it was things like replacing glucometers or re-prescribing medications that people need, like their blood pressure or thyroxines, hearing aid batteries, all sorts of things that you never would have thought of. But people lost everything, their Medicare cards. We couldn't, like, we collaborated with everybody, and that went as far as like the local pharmacist to identify what people's normal medications were so that our GP could re-prescribe them, and then we'd source them and supply them and go as far as like delivering them for the patient. So it was a complete service.
I think what you're describing here too, though, I mean, like you said earlier, there's a lot of well-intentioned people, and especially, you know, in the clinical sense, most of us are in these jobs because we want to serve the people, we want to assist. And a lot of people, when these things happen, I guess, are keen to get involved, but are not sure how to do that appropriately or even legally sometimes. And I think what's important here is what you and your husband have established is some coordination and some control. You know, you gave some structure to an unstructured area. It was to provide, you know, sometimes even the most basic of basic primary health care. You know, you're talking about a hearing aid battery, that can be life-changing for someone in that kind of circumstance as well. I love that after the first day you went back and worked on a SMEAC. That actually warms my heart. I think that's great.
So for our listeners, what's a SMEAC?
Well, it's a military acronym.
It's obviously a very effective tool to like get to the point of what the objectives is and what you're trying to achieve and how you're going to do that.
It's essentially the beginnings of a strategic plan, for those who are unaware. But, I mean, it's literally situation, mission, execute. I mean, it goes on. There's a number of different ways it is done because, you know, sometimes there's enemy involved. We don't have any enemy in a flood.
The mud is your enemy.
Do you know what I love about this, Kate, is, you know, years ago we actually established a similar response overseas to an earthquake. And, it again, we wanted to do it the right way. We wanted to give some structure to it, not just haphazard. And the people that I actually developed one of these projects with, we actually pulled out a napkin and wrote SMEAC on it. And that was the start of our original strategic plan that then morphed into a needs analysis and everything from there. So I think there's so many lessons of this. One is we need a little bit of control and coordination at a professional level. The collaboration with the local governments who are involved in actually responding. You know, there can be a lot of well-intentioned organizations not collaborating, and it just can confuse things.
Yes. Yeah, go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say it. I was curious, what started you in Lennox Head? Was that actually a request from the health service?
That was our first. So I was emailed through from New South Wales Health, again, the functional area coordinator, who was put in that position as obviously the state disaster plans were enacted. So I was sent through an email of a patient list of people to follow up on and evacuation centres to check in on it. And that didn't take us very long. Most of those areas weren't too impacted. So basically we were done by mid-morning. So by that point, we had permission to continue south effectively. So we went through Lismore, we checked in there. They were pretty good. They had a good setup and, again, a reasonably good command and control. We tried to attempt to get into Woodburn, which we'd heard was still closed. We couldn't get in. We rerouted so many times, but they were still shut off. There was no access. And then, yeah, discovered Corakai and just... We, you know, found who was, you know, obviously SES were the lead agency for a flood and natural disaster. So we found them. But then, I mean, the agencies were all fatiguing. They were all local responses, locals and victims themselves. And by about day 5-6, they'd been working round the clock and were absolutely shattered. So that was what I found important too, is that, yes, we were going to offer to do all these things, but I'd already come up with how we were going to do it, coming with the solutions, because they're already decision fatigued. So if I came and said, yes, we're doing it, this is how we're going to do it, all I need from you is just the permission to go ahead with it and we're ready to go. So we're completely self-sufficient. We brought everything down, our own, you know, our own radios, petrol, food, water. So we're aware that we didn't want to further impact the deficiencies that are already on the ground there. So we didn't want to be an additional burden by showing up and wanting to help.
No, it's already a vulnerable community, isn't it? We you know, you don't want to put some taxing requests on them either. But where was the funding for this stuff developed from in such a quick amount of time?
So it came through the disaster plans that were enacted. So they... Again, what happened was about day 3 into our volunteer deployment, we were approached and asked to continue on to stay in the region of Corakai and on the outskirts and look after that particular region. So from then on, we were contracted for the next 10 days to continue coming down and reaching out to those, you know, the community that couldn't get to medical care. And that included jumping on, you know, collaborating with SES and Defence and getting on a flotilla of boats up the Richmond River to communities or properties that hadn't been accessed or seen anybody for going on a week and doing healthcare checks on farmers. And again, on some days we used air resources to go out to marooned families on properties that... hadn't had anything but food drops and hadn't seen anyone, and all requiring tetanus, re-prescription of medications, antibiotics for chest infections, for exposure to just inhabitable conditions they were living in. But again, choosing not to leave because they had to look after their stock and wildlife, you know, stock and animals or their homes, and just desperate to salvage whatever they could.
Not even just needing that clinical care either. I mean, you're talking about people who've been marooned for days after a major event. You know, you might have been just running basic health assessments on some of them, but it's just that reassurance of some human interaction.
Absolutely.
Oh, there was an assessment
with mental health as well, and that was ongoing also. So, yeah, we identified some people that we were worried about that we had followed up, and in some situations when we were requested to go to areas, we had to have police escort with us for situations allegedly for domestic violence and those sorts of things. So that was something we always considered for ourselves too, was safety, just simple things like wearing life jackets on the boats, working in pairs. Those sorts of things were always considered. So we applied, because it was a disaster, and I've got a bit of experience in the MIMS principles. So for those, it's the Major Incident Medical Support.
More acronyms.
Principles. Yeah. There's 7 key principles for an all-hazard approach. So I applied a lot of those. And those include things like the command and how are we going to do transport, assessment, triage, treatment, command and control, and those sorts of things. So that
she's
was part
not
of
a, she's not a nurse on this, is she, Nick? No. She might be a registered nurse, but she's actually playing the game of well, I mean, there's several hats, but I mean, there's manager, there's director, there's coordinator, there's it's interesting how many different non-clinical roles she was actually playing to establish essentially a clinical platform.
100%. And all these, like, right at the start of this podcast, he really highlighted how almost fragile things that we normally take for granted are, like the ability to go down to the GP, see the GP in their office, get a script, go to the pharmacy, fill that script and continue on about my day, or even be able to call an ambulance and them able to physically get to you, which is one of the big problems ambulance services have is physically not being able to get to anyone. They can't just physically can't do their business as usual because they can't get anywhere. But even just down to my hearing aid's flat or it drowned in the water, things like that, you just don't even think of. We just take that stuff for granted sometimes.
It's so easily accessible.
I know. It's like day to day, 99% of the time.
Yeah.
The week before this event, everything was normal.
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing. Kate, it's an amazing story. And I love meeting people such as yourselves and your husband, anyone else who was involved, because it's really developing a community of like-minded people and encouraging them into a common goal. What's next for Task Force Flood Assist? Is this something that you're looking at maybe building further, or is this a one-off?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see this as a permanent structure of, you know, private medical service being able to respond to disasters. I recently spoke at the disaster management conference on the Gold Coast, and part of the theme was, or recognition for these agencies such as SES, Fire East, police and government agencies, was recognising the potential of private services such as medical that can really fill a gap in capability, especially when there is fatigue, when it's an ongoing long disaster. A lot of people think, oh, disaster, it's quick and snappy and let's deploy right now. But the truth is, some of these, I mean, we're going on weeks and weeks of the Northern New South Wales floods. And they, I mean, they're still impacted. But there's just such potential there. And I'd love to see, for example, the company that I worked for, the 1300 Medics, that perhaps it might be a branch one day of a capability where you've got paramedics, nurses, nurse practitioners, doctors that have all the capability, all the clinical governance structure, the command structure already tested and established, that can deploy at short notice in a tactical space, again, because we've got our ambulances, radios, all those sorts of things that can go to vulnerable areas, get given objectives, and then apply them and go forth.
Kate, how many patients did you see throughout the entire
in day? Hearing? 130 people.
In a day?
No, over the 10 days, it was 130.
Wow,
you guys hustle.
They moved.
A lot. I did the statistics. I think it was about 40 to 50 tetanus administrations. We commenced probably about a dozen on antibiotics from chest infections that are exposed to mold. We identified some really vulnerable people in the community too, which... and what I mean by that is like the aging community. So we had like a 90-odd-year-old man that sustained significant skin tears trying to restart his generator, but he lived on a property out in Bugawalpin, which was, you know, 20-minute drive for us through arduous terrain. And then by the time we got to his property, it was park the cars, walk another 2 kilometres up to his actual house. And here he was on his own. So what we were able to do was collaborate also after treating him with, the community nurse hub, so he'll have ongoing, you know, care through aged care services and make sure that he's integrated into those systems.
That's incredible. That's so good. And that's actually 130 patients. That's a huge burden off the health system. And, you know, you might have prevented multiple assessments of those patients down the line by getting on top of their problems early. So that's fantastic. Well done. Kate, before we wrap up, what would you say to people who have these ideas and want to go out and challenge the norm and get outside their comfort zone? What advice would you give them?
I think come up with your solutions before you approach the right people. Like, have a plan in place of how you want to do it and how you're going to do it and who with, and so that you come with them already with a plan ready to go, so that's just easy for them to say yes.
You're not really coming with a question, are you? You're coming with a statement or an answer.
Yes.
And that can develop as it goes as well. Is there anywhere that any paramedics, nurses, doctors, any allied health that are interested in getting involved can go to at the moment, or is this still being built?
Oh, it's still in a very premature phase. Again, like, I'd love to see it develop, but, I mean, unfortunately, disasters are never going to go away, and we're always going to have significant rain events and fire events and those, you know, awful things that happen in the environment at the moment, the climate change, whatever. But, we'll just watch this space. It's exciting. I think an opportunity that as we see more private medical services build and develop and fill gaps where government agencies can't provide medical services at the moment, that I think this is a real potential for medical services to move into.
Nick, we said trailblazers and trendsetters at the start. I reckon Kadia qualifies as one of those 100%. Nursing trailblazers. That's 100%. Awesome.
Well done, Kate. Congratulations on everything you achieved. And well done to the team that came down with you.
Yeah, they were fantastic. Absolutely instrumental.
Everyone's done a fantastic job. I think that's all we have time for. Kate, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks, Sonny.
No worries, hey.
Thanks.